Call this meeting to order of Labor and Industry Finance and Policy. Today is Tuesday, March 14th. Pi Day, anyway. Representative Mecklen, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I have reviewed the minutes, and I so move them, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mecklen moves the minutes from March 9th. All in favor, approval of the minutes, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, the motion prevails. Our first bill on our calendar, and members today and the audience, there's going to be a lot of flipping around because we have people with bills being heard here, and some of our committee members have bills elsewhere, including myself. I have a bill I got to present at another committee, so it's going to be a fun committee today. Anyway, every day's fun, yes. Representative Berg, you want to move your bill, and this is going to Dental Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move my bill, House File 406, to be before the committee, to be sent to the general, re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Do you have any amendments? I see, yes, there's an amendment. Is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my amendment, and I move my amendment.
And you want to explain what your amendment does briefly?
Yes, thank you. So our amendment is essentially to make the Department of Public Safety the enforcement mechanism. And so we're amending to include 299F.51 to the DPS State Fire Marshal's Division, the authority to include this as a part of our hotel inspections authority.
Thank you. Questions, members, on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A230060 amendment to put the bill in the fashion that the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's added. Representative Berg, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a fairly simple bill, but it is one that affects each and every one of us. I like to say, as one of my jobs outside of what I do here, I'm a flight attendant, and so I stay in hotels for a living. And so what this bill does is it requires carbon monoxide alarms in all of the rooms intended for sleeping. So not in the hallway, not outside in the living room of a suite, in each room that is intended for sleeping with limited exceptions. And so it will be on the owners of the hotels to install those alarms and to also make sure they are working and do required maintenance. So currently, for hotels and lodging houses, the state fire code requires the installation of a carbon monoxide alarm within every sleeping room or within 10 feet if there is no source of carbon monoxide inside the room, or within 15 to 25 feet of every fixed source of carbon monoxide. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn my time over to my testifier, Ms. Leslie Lieneman.
And welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Lieneman, and I am here as a survivor of carbon monoxide poisoning and as a mom to ask you to lead the nation in protecting people who travel and stay in hotels and people who work in hotels from becoming injured or dying of carbon monoxide poisoning. I provided a packet of information for you that gives you a great deal of data about both the prevalence of carbon monoxide injuries in hotels, the underreporting of carbon monoxide leaks and injuries in motels and hotels, and the long-term effects to people who suffer carbon monoxide exposure if they survive carbon monoxide exposure in hotels. And I particularly want to draw your attention to a study that was recently published only a couple of months ago, in which it was determined that there is a correlation between carbon monoxide poisoning and subsequent development of epilepsy, and that correlation is particularly strong in young people. I have to ask you, with that knowledge, how safe you feel checking into a hotel with your children, knowing that no state in this country requires the level of carbon monoxide detection that I am asking you to adopt. and I'm doing that because I have found, as I've talked to people about my experience, that they assume there are carbon monoxide detectors in their rooms. They're surprised when they are not. I also was surprised. I traveled with my son to a hockey tryout. He was trying for an NAHL team. We were to be there for 4 days, and the first night we both became ill with headaches, and the next day my son struggled with numbness in his feet as he tried to skate. We went back to the hotel a second night and became more ill, and on the third night we became so ill that we were dizzy and nauseated. I was vomiting, and I took us to the emergency room. Once we were at the emergency room, because we had described general illness symptoms, it took an hour until the blood tests came back showing that we had dangerous levels of carbon monoxide in our blood, and it took an hour for them to send the emergency personnel to evacuate the hotel, all because there was no carbon monoxide detector in our room. Most people believe that if there is no gas appliance in the room, they're safe. That is not true. You can check the data packet that I have provided for you. Carbon monoxide can travel through drywall. It travels through air vents, from parking structures, from even vehicles running in parking lots that are open to air if they're parked near an air vent. In our case, it came from a water heater across an open air hallway. So even though the source was not anywhere near our room, it was across an open air hallway, it traveled through the open spaces in the ceiling and caused us severe carbon monoxide poisoning, as a result of which my 22-year-old son has a permanent neurological injury. Throughout the 3 years that I have been advocating for this bill, people have criticized me for being emotional. I do not apologize for that. But I am not asking you to make an emotional decision here. I am asking you to perform the function that the people elect you to perform, which is to protect them when they don't know they're in danger, to lead the nation in understanding when you can, as a matter of public policy, prevent a child from developing epilepsy, from dying, from developing any number of the types of complications that can come following, including elevated potential for Parkinson's disease, elevated potential for heart complications over the course of their life. Read the packet that I provided you and you will see. This is not a minor issue. It is a prevalent issue. You cannot prevent carbon monoxide leaks from happening, but you can prevent carbon monoxide injury and death in hotels through simple installation of a carbon monoxide detector. Over the course of the 3 years that I've been advocating for this protection and asking you to lead the nation in doing so, the primary objective has been money. I can tell you that in the hotel where we stayed, there had been a prior carbon monoxide poisoning that had injured two people prior to the time I checked my child into that hotel. They didn't install carbon monoxide detectors until after we were injured. And when they did, it cost them $35. Had they spent that $35 3 weeks earlier, I would not have been injured. My son would not have been injured. Carbon monoxide detectors are inexpensive. They last 5 to 7 years. This is not something that you can afford to risk for your families or for the families of Minnesota or for those of people who travel to the state of Minnesota. This bill will save someone's life. And so I ask you, if you have any doubt of anything that I've said, look in the packet I've provided. It's all there for you. And I ask you, please, to adopt this bill.
Thank you, Ann, for your testimony. Next person I have on the list, I got two other testifiers, Jill Sims. If you want to come down, and if you want, you can pull a chair over. So, and welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jill Sims, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Hospitality Minnesota. We represent Minnesota's restaurants, lodging, resort, and campground sectors. The number one priority of hotel and lodging operators is to ensure the safety of all guests and all employees. Traditionally, the fire code is adopted and revised through the rulemaking process, and from what I can tell, versions of this legislation date back to 2018, 2019, when the Minnesota State Fire Code did not require carbon monoxide detectors in rooms with fuel sources. However, in March 2020, the Minnesota State Fire Code was updated through the rulemaking process to require carbon monoxide detection in hotel sleeping units where there are fuel burning appliances or if they are served by a fuel burning forced air furnace. This change to the fire code addresses the safety concern that's outlined in HF 406. In your packets, we included a copy of the flow chart from the fire marshal, as well as the entire section, chapter 915 of the fire code, which outlines the requirements not only for the sleeping rooms, but throughout hotels where there may be a source that has carbon monoxide, or could produce, carbon monoxide. So today, in the state of Minnesota, if you stay in a hotel room that is served by a fuel burning appliance or has a fuel source, there is a carbon monoxide detector as required by fire code. In Minnesota, we have 87,000 hotel rooms across nearly 1,100 properties. These are inspected on a three-year cycle by the fire marshal. We really appreciate the author's amendment to align those inspections with the current practice of hotel safety inspections. Additionally, we ask for consideration of the implementation timeline. Generally, when fire code is adopted, there's an education and implementation timeline for hotels to appropriately plan and budget for changes. As I noted earlier, there are 87,000 hotel rooms in Minnesota, and the pre-installation cost is about $30 to $50 per unit. But at this time, we do not have clarity on how many units would need to be ordered, what the product of supply is, and if hotel have budget or labor availability to install by a presumed July deadline. And again, I think there's thought that there's probably maybe 30,000, 40,000 rooms based on my conversations with the fire marshal that do already have this. But we'd probably need to do more research to get a more accurate number as what the amount of rooms that are already served by that fuel source. But in general, we encourage the author and the committee to continue working with the hotel, to work with the hotel industry as well with the fire marshal's office to better understand the implementation timeline that's typically used for fire code, and we look forward to working with the author and the state fire marshals on that and better understanding existing rules and regulations to ensure that policy is best aligned with practice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next I have Ken Weaver. And I hope I said that last name right. You
said it perfectly, thank you.
I before E except after C anyway. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ken Weaver. I am the Director of Property Operations at the St. Paul Hotel. My position is responsible for the building maintenance, security, housekeeping, and front desk and construction operations at the hotel. I've been in this position for 30 years, and previously I worked in power plant engineering for 8 years. It is my responsibility to ensure every guest has a safe and comfortable experience. Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas produced by burning wood, propane, natural gas, other fuels. Improperly ventilated fuel-burning appliances may allow carbon monoxide to accumulate to dangerous levels in enclosed spaces. This bill is proposing a one-size-fits-all requirement to install detectors in all guest rooms. The Minnesota State Fire Code does a thorough job of addressing carbon monoxide in Chapter 915, including installation of carbon monoxide detectors where appropriate. Regular inspections ensure these codes are met and safety is provided for all occupants. Lodging properties come in a variety of configurations. For example, our downtown property, our boiler and water heaters are two blocks away. So there's no boilers, there's no gas, water heaters, anything in our property. We have 12 floors and 255 rooms within the hotel, and none of this gas-fired equipment anywhere near those guest rooms. We also have fresh air duct systems that are roof mounted away from anywhere near a garage, anything like that. So fresh air is consistently applied to all the guest rooms in the hotel, and a duct that's so large I could walk down the duct bringing fresh air into the hotel. So so basically that's the message, is that it shouldn't be a one size fits all. It's in the cases where it's necessary due to the existing fire code, put in the carbon monoxide detectors. If you have that gas-fired water heater, there should have been a detector in that room. If you have gas-fired equipment, forced air furnaces, there should have been detectors in those rooms. So I believe there's adequate rules to make sure that this doesn't happen. I appreciate the opportunity to allow you to share my experience, and I'm happy to be a resource in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. And I hear that there's some thought about possibly working on trying to work something out with the author. That you'd be willing to do that, Mr. Weaver?
Of course, I'd be willing to work with the author to work out a reasonable set of rules.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver.
Thank you.
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, if I could allow my testifier to speak to those misunderstandings.
Ms. Lindemann.
Thank you. It is important for you to listen very carefully to what you have just heard. The suggestion that the current requirement that carbon monoxide detectors be present when there is a furnace or a heater are inadequate. I provided you a spreadsheet of all a spreadsheet of examples of carbon monoxide injuries suffered in hotels across the country through October of 2022, starting from 1969. You will note that many of them are not furnaces or boilers. They are pool heaters, they are water heaters, they are vehicle emissions coming from inside. And so the current regulations don't even begin to cover all the potential sources of carbon monoxide. And you don't want your child to be the test case if you miss this and get this wrong, quite frankly. But in addition, since I suffered this injury and my son suffered this injury, I have traveled with carbon monoxide detectors with me anytime I've been in a hotel. Twice since that time, in hotels in the state of Minnesota, my carbon monoxide detector has alerted me to unsafe levels of carbon monoxide when there was no hotel carbon monoxide detector or nothing alerting, including a hotel in downtown St. Paul. One of them was because a vehicle in the parking lot was running next to an air intake, and the other, frankly, they argued with me, and I notified them on my way out the door, and I left, and I saw emergency vehicles come. I don't know what they determined the source to be. But they gave me the exact same explanation that what I was saying was impossible because the boiler was not anywhere near my room, and yet my personal carbon monoxide digital reader was telling me that it had exceeded 50 parts per million, which is dangerous, and there should have been an alarm going, but there wasn't one in my room. I don't know what the source of that was, but I know that it was present. I know that it was dangerous. I know that it was addressed by emergency personnel when the hotel management was saying that it wasn't possible. So which side of this do you want to be on? Do you want to err on the side of caution, or do you want to err on the side of misinformation? I would ask you to err on the side of caution and read the materials I've provided to you about the sources of carbon monoxide poisoning in this country.
Thank you, Ms. Lindemann. Questions for the author? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Berg, for bringing your bill here and seeking to put us in alignment with our other, especially residential, building code. As it relates to this bill, what conversations have you had with the concerns that we heard from the hospitality industry, realizing some of their legitimate concerns over timing and things like this? Can you tell us a little bit about the context of your discussions with them?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. I've talked to a few when I have been out and about. I presented this bill last session. And unfortunately, it was stopped in the Senate. And so I had a whole interim to go ahead and talk to folks as I traveled doing my other job. I started looking for carbon monoxide detectors in every hotel room because much like I imagine many of you sitting in this room, I never thought about it. And I should point out that I stay in a variety of types of hotels, from kind of questionable Best Westerns or La Quintas all the way up to some Sheratons, Marriotts, what have you. Great that the St. Paul Hotel is a luxury establishment that can have some of these more innovative and safe ways to have their mechanics that are necessary off-site. That's not the case for a lot of lower tier hotels where a lot of us stay. And so, yes, I have spoken with people who have a concern over the cost. Then I tell them you can get a carbon monoxide detector. And you'll note this bill does not say it has to be one that is actually wired through the hotel, which is more expensive. It can be a battery operated one. They're anywhere from $15 to $35, which is even with 87,000 hotel rooms, whole lot cheaper than a wrongful death lawsuit.
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Berg. I would continue and to encourage you to work with the stakeholders. You know, we have a statewide organization here in Hospitality, Minnesota, which I believe that they have some very, very reasonable just requests to work together to make sure that we get this right. And so I'd encourage you to do that. And I'm going to mention a particular topic here. As I look at this bill, there is no enactment clause, a particular place to say, you know, on such and such a date, we must hold to this standard. And I think that having humility about the way that we do this is really important because of the way that we do our inspections. It's so key that we're working in partnership with businesses who want to do right by our customers to ensure the safety of those staying at our hotels.
And Representative Schultz, I know if this is your first term, but if there is no enacting or legislation, August 1st is normal enactment date if there's not in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former staff here, sometimes I hear July 1st. So August 1st being another, January 1st the following year. And I want to raise this point specifically because there is a very natural building code inspection timeline for when inspections are made. And I think that we could, as a body, we could marry up the language for the next inspection, be it like over the course of, for example, the next 3 years. And I wanted to find out from the author if that's something that you would consider.
Vice Chair Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, sorry, that was a lot. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. I really appreciate your concern for my humility. For me, actually, I've had a couple conversations with Hospitality Minnesota. Happy to continue talking with them. We've also had conversations with the fire marshals. And essentially, what this bill does is it says, okay, so your first violation is a warning, right? We go through like steps up until there is a fine for them. So I understand about thinking about, well, do they have the labor to do this? Do they need a little time to try to finance this, build it into their budget? I can appreciate that. I can also appreciate the folks that have said specifically in this room that they are responsible for, and one of their leading values is to make sure every guest is safe. So for me, that is built into your cost of business, so they can go ahead and implement that as soon as possible.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a really quick follow-up to that. So, in engaging on this particular piece of legislation, I have heard concerns from many that we may not even have access to the equipment that's necessary. And so I'm simply to provide some certainty to get us to a place where we can get this installed in a timely manner, keeps people safe, but is also recognizing we may have some challenges and we don't want to find a business simply based upon supply chain concerns.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author of the bill, to back up what he said, I install a lot of smoke alarms and CO detectors, and there is a major, major shortage of them right now, and it's terrible. And you're talking about a lot of them, and maybe one thought would be to prioritize the most volatile structures first, kind of like what the gentleman testified. All their equipment's off-site, and it's all piped in. So that maybe goes to the back of the line, whatever. But you also said that they're required to be only battery operated. Is that correct?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Mecklen. I said we have not determined whether it's the more expensive one that is wired into the hotel wiring system or whether it's battery operated. And to respond to Representative Schultz and then again to you, of course, if it's a supply chain issue, we can't just wish them into existence. So happy to respect that that might be a delay. There's nothing we can do about that. That's not the fault of the business. If they're simply not in circulation, we can't expect that. So that would naturally be a part of looking how at how we implement this and if we can do it by the date set forth in the bill. But simply to not do it, especially if you think about your kids, your grandkids, your new wife, sleeping in a room that you may not know is dangerous. Outside of supply chain issues, this is pretty serious.
Representative Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't disagree. I actually passed out in a clam fish house once from a crappy little buddy heater. So, nevertheless, it says on that a carbon monoxide alarm shall receive their primary power from the building wiring. So, in the bill, it repeatedly lists carbon monoxide alarm. Until you get down to line 2.23, you've stricken alarms and put in the word detectors. So you have a conflict of language here. So I'm just pointing it out. I don't necessarily need an answer on it, but just to clarify, because I think it indicates that you may need a hardwired in one way, but and it says that they must be hardwired. So just to make it very clear what everybody's up against. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berg, I appreciate your last line. Basically, we've had a theme in the committee where punishable by many thousands of dollars on businesses. So I do appreciate your reasonableness on line 3.4. The first penalty is just a warning, and I think that hotels will certainly get that warning. In doing the research from this last year, because we saw this last year, I believe, as well, there was some testifiers that said that in certain hotel rooms, especially up in the skyrise, above the fifth floor and up above, there's no way to even have any carbon produced from there. So have you considered just having a carbon detector that would be just in areas that would be dutifully needed where carbon could be detected, not rooms that there would ever be a case of carbon being detected? Is that something that you would have considered?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I think that for the sake of getting this right, continuity is important. If the bill is passed, and the reasoning behind it is that it must go in every room intended for sleeping, then it means every room intended for sleeping. There are a lot of reasons, as you heard our testifier say, that carbon monoxide can be found in a room unexpectedly. And so I think as we want to be consistent and make sure that we are adhering to the letter of the law, it just makes sense. However, thank you for seeing me as reasonable. It's something that I could think about and could consider. But having heard the testimony, having there being so much research that says people are injured or dying because they are poisoned by carbon monoxide in a place they never expected it, I think it'd be best just to make sure we're safe.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative McDonald.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, on the reasonableness, because I certainly it is with great reason that we want to protect all people that are in a hotel. So a couple of things. Just again, I'll go back to last year. We heard this bill last year, so some of us remember some of the testifying, some of the evidence, and some of the facts, and some of the things that were dispelled. The fire chiefs, I was just curious. I was speaking to my fire chief last year on this. I have his opinion. I won't share it now. But have you spoken to the fire chiefs and gotten their expertise on a carbon detector, either an alarm or a detector, in rooms just that would produce carbon? Because we do want to, within reason, adopt a bill that has great reason. And if there's rooms that simply there's no way to get carbon monoxide, I just wanted to know what your opinions on that, if you had discussed it with the fire marshal and given their expertise.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald, pardon me, Lead McDonald. I have not posed that specific question to the fire marshal, but last session when we had this, we had a Zoom with the Department of Safety, and there was, you know, the fire marshal leadership. That particular question did not come up, but they were very pleased that this was a bill that was being brought forward, which is why you see an enforcement mechanism this time, because we did do the work to make sure that that happened.
Follow up, Representative McDonald.
Lastly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, for that answer. I think that, you know, this is your bill, so you can do with it what you believe is the best interest for all parties interested. I would suggest, just from my humble opinion, that you look into the reasonableness of timing. I think August 1st certainly is for 87,000 rooms. Maybe in rural Minnesota that's a little easier, but for the Twin Cities and the suburbs, that it might be a little tough to achieve. And I think you want to be reasoned within your bill. So perhaps you put that in your bill, maybe you could do amendment as it go forward, that it's more than August 1st. You know, once school starts and the summer ends and the holidays begin, hotels get busy again with people traveling for holidays, so it might be a good idea to just look into that. And then lastly, I would recommend as well to talk to the fire chief. Just being here for 13 years on various committees, from Department of from Public Safety to Health and Human Service, you name it, I guess I've been on it. We depend on the fire chief's expertise, and he can perhaps, or she, give you some great advice on the reasonableness of this important bill.
Representative Berg,
response? Of course, I'm open to the suggestion of having more conversations. I will, however, say that we are past conversations and on to the concern for safety of everybody. And let's just hope during the summer, before it gets busy during the holidays, that we don't lose anyone because we didn't move on this. But thanks for the suggestion.
And we'll go next to Representative Meyer before we go to closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Hill. And Representative Berg, I'm just going to piggyback a little bit off what Lead McDonald talked about. You know, every property is different. I know we're here. I've got four little kids, too. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I'm just interested in talking to some of those fire chiefs where we can see that you got a parking garage underneath a building. And, of course, you know, like in my own house, that can come up into one of the bedrooms. Interested to know what their response or expertise would be to say, okay, that can travel up three floors. So if it's three floors, reasonableness to me would mean, you know, requiring this on four floors. So I think every property can be different. And again, you know, trying to make sure that we look at properties like, you know, the hotel owner that was here and other properties, I think is something I'm hoping you're willing to look at.
Representative Berg.
Thank you. There's a fire chief theme over here. I will let you know that I do appreciate that, because the more conversations you can have with me, the, you know, more experts, the better. And so I can certainly look into having those conversations. You know, every year at the Capitol, we have the Fallen Firefighter Memorial, and they choose one House member and one member of the Senate and one member of the Congress and the governor. And the memorial that we had last spring, I was chosen as the House member to speak because I talked to my local fire department, which, by the way, Burnsville has top-notch fire department leading in innovation. So I have a great relationship with the fire marshals, fire chiefs. Happy to have those conversations. Gonna say I'm still pretty stuck on let's just save lives.
Follow up?
Yeah. Nope. Thank you.
Wonderful. Representative Berg, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a side note that was not mentioned, I apologize for not bringing this up earlier, Airbnb is actually requiring every property to have a carbon monoxide detector. If the property cannot afford it, Airbnb buys it for them. That's how serious Airbnb as a whole across the nation takes people staying in their dwellings. So that's pretty impressive right there. I will just close by saying I have known Ms. Lieneman and her family, her son, her husband for maybe a decade. It's been a really long time. She is a brilliant, award-winning, two-time Attorney of the Year in Minnesota. And her son is a phenomenal hockey player. I knew them before this happened, and I clearly know them now, and there is a big difference. And I hope I'm not being too personal saying that. There is a big difference in who they were and who they are. And there was no reason for it. A $35 smoke detector, which is also an alarm. Semantics, a detector, much like a, you know, smoke detector alarms. So semantics in the language, but I hear you. So as we're looking at our families, our kids, our grandkids, our spouses, loved ones, what is the price for their safety when they travel? That's the question. And I think we can all answer it with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 406, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. We'll give Representative Berg a moment, and she will resume the gavel. All right. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1996 from Representative Leslegard. Chair moves that the House File 1996 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, former chair, now to Madam Chair.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Representative Leslegard, state your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dave Leslegard. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present House File 1996 relating to the Operating Engineer Pathway Program. Most simply put, the Operating Engineer Pathway Program is a statewide high school class elective that exposes students to opportunities in the construction industry with an outreach to underrepresented communities. I am proud to have authored this initial legislation 2 years ago, where I know that it had an impact on people's lives. It had bipartisan support, which I believe this will also have bipartisan support, and this program has already exceeded expectations. And we appreciate the opportunity to present that and go over that with you today. If it's okay, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers for this portion.
Thank you, Representative. I believe first up we have Jenny Winkler. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Winkler. I'm the Director of Workforce and Community Development for Operating Engineers Local 49. Thank you for your time and consideration today. Local 49 and its partners, Minnesota Virtual Academy and Houston Public Schools, is offering a promising career path to students all throughout the state of Minnesota in the field of heavy equipment operations, offering family-supporting wages, top-tier benefits, no college debt, and they're jobs that, frankly, can't be outsourced during these trying times. The pathway at a glance, we offer flexible online class schedules. The vast majority of our students stay enrolled in their local school districts. We offer hands-on training events with industry partners. Students receive potential for high school credit, college credit, and apprenticeship credit. And it's free to all public high school students throughout the state of Minnesota with no budgetary impact on schools when the students pass the course. A brief history of the pathway program. The program launched in 2020. The legislature initially approved $100,000 of funding in 2021. Due to the high level of enrollments and appetite for this program, we are spending that contribution more rapidly than we anticipated. We now have more than 100 schools that are involved in the pathway program, and have currently 171 enrollments this spring with projected growth for the fall. The courses that are offered in the Pathway program, each class is one semester and includes hands-on opportunities for the students as well. Those courses offered are construction exploration that is specific to heavy equipment, not general construction, basic grade and construction math, equipment fundamentals, and basic equipment maintenance. How the classes work, we strategically made the decision to partner with Minnesota Virtual Academy so that all students throughout the state of Minnesota, grades 9 through 12, had access to these courses. The curriculum was developed in partnership with Local 49 to prepare students for all aspects of life and work in our industry. Students, as I said, typically remain enrolled in their brick-and-mortar school district. The coursework is delivered virtually through a learning platform with Minnesota Virtual Academy. And because we have partnerships with so many school districts throughout the state of Minnesota, we couldn't possibly build a schedule that would accommodate all the elective course openings. Therefore, live teaching Class Connect sessions are recorded for the student to have access to at any point. We also, because CTE students typically are hands-on learners, while the coursework is offered virtually, industry partners step up and donate in-kind support as well to host hands-on opportunities for our students. We've had partners such as Ziegler Cat, Ames Construction, and Local 49 Training Center has hosted a few hands-on training sessions for the students as well. This allows students to get the feel for heavy equipment, get some seat time, and expose students to the robust offerings within the heavy equipment field of heavy equipment operations. I want to state again, because people sometimes miss this, this is a 3-for-1 opportunity for students and their families. They get high school elective credit. They get articulated college credit at North Hennepin Community College for 3 of the 4 modules, all except the explorations module. And then for those who do decide, I'm interested in this field, they also can earn credit toward our registered apprenticeship program at Local 49 as well. I'll now turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Mary Morum, to provide further testimony.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mary Morum, Superintendent of Minnesota Virtual Academy in Houston Public Schools. Thank you so much for having us here today. This is our second time speaking, so it's great. So the first slide that we have is, this is the coverage of the state. And if I compared the last 3 years of where we have been to where we are now, we just about have the whole entire state covered. And I think that's one of the very positive things of this. We are impacting kids through the whole state of Minnesota. So even though we are geographically located down in the southeast, we are covering the whole entire state. And as you can see, we have some work to do. So part of this bill would be helping us to reach these areas we still need to reach yet. So as you can see, very expansive across the state. So equity and outreach, again, it's a statewide promotional program, including repeated appearances from the news media has been very beneficial. We have 19 female current students and 7 that identify with Black, Indigenous, and people of color. So again, we're targeting, trying to reach all those equity, and Jenny and I have been on teams to promote that as well. Our senior success stories, there's many success stories, but we currently have 56 seniors in the program that just graduated in 2022. Out of those, 23 of them have completed all 4 pathway programs. So for a brand new program, it's very successful. 22 have indicated that they are going to go in the work field. And more than 10% of the seniors last year entered the apprenticeship program, and that's our partnership with the 49. Here is a young lady. This is a young lady that I've been blessed to have as a former high school student and then as her superintendent, and she graduated, and she is currently enrolled in the union and working for a construction company, so very successful. These are just quotes from students. This is another student that said, people do a great job of teaching you everything you need to know in the field trips. They really provide the knowledge you need to get into this trade. One of the cool things, if you ever get an opportunity to come to one of these events, I know some of you have been at some of our events, and it's great, but it's not just about the current students, about their younger siblings, their cousins, their mom and dads, everybody attends. So it's really a family event, so it's a neat opportunity. All right, so the impact on schools, this is the great part, right? You would have heard hurrahs back in August when we sent all the districts their check from their refund back from us, saying that, you know what, this is, they're like, well, what is this for? They didn't even realize that they were getting their money back. So there was a lot of hurrays around the state from everybody that was participating. They have completion of this course, then they get the full reimbursement at the end. So that's what this additional money will do. And it's in the best interest of students without worrying about the bottom line. So how can we work together as schools to do better things for kids? I mean, that's where it's all at. It has outperformed our expectations. We want to continue to grow the program. We are down to, out of that original money, I think there's only like 15,000 left. So we are in need of additional funds. So that's how many people have. So we are asking for $300,000 this biennium to ensure that we can continue to grow this program and impact kids all over the state. Here's our contact information. My name is not up there, but Stephanie is our person who does all the enrolling and works with the students hands-on. And I'm just here to promote all the wonderful work that Jenny and all of you have supported. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Great presentation. We appreciate that. It looks like we have Akethia Lloyd as a testifier here. And if we could keep our remarks short, I would appreciate that. We have another bill coming up, and we will be adjourning on time today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Akethia Lloyd. I'm a certified crane operator and now in this position a career navigator for International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49. As we all know in this room, we all know how valuable and important it is to be able to even make a choice. And I'm here to tell you how I got in. Back in 2013, I was leaving a very dysfunctional marriage at the time with my five-year-old daughter. I was a single mom, started a position in maintenance at Summit Academy OIC in North Minneapolis, working part-time in maintenance, didn't have any transportation, was just on public transportation at that time, and I was seeing all these students graduate from the programs there at that school. And my daughter was my purpose and my reason for entering this industry and starting a career. And I eventually enrolled as a student at Summit Academy and in the pre-apprentice heavy equipment operators program there. Only woman in my class and at the top of my class graduated and eventually ended up getting hired on with Lunda Construction that does a lot of bridge work. I've been blessed to have the opportunity to work on the Stillwater Bridge project, Clearwater, Minnesota, doing demolition work, worked on the 35W project, as well as light rail before taking on this position now. It's very important that kids nowadays, you know, we see what they're doing, what they're going through. A lot of kids are in adult positions that they don't need to be, and it's not fair to them, but we all know that knowledge is power, and this program here provides them with just another opportunity for them to be able to even make a decision in order to do something different. Because we all know that college is not for everyone. There's plenty of kids out there that they don't even plan to go to college. They don't have the support, the encouragement in order to even make a choice to be able to do something different with their lives and live outside the box. That's why I'm asking, you know, you all here today to reimburse the program, because it can definitely change lives. And just being in this industry, it helped change mine as well. And if I'd have known about a program like this in high school, it would have been life-changing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Discussion, members, and can we keep it efficient? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author of the bill. Thank you for bringing this forward, continuing this this good work. My question would be for Ms. Winkler or Ms. Morum. What are the biggest challenges you face to getting this program more fully implemented across the state or into schools that haven't yet taken the idea on?
Ms. Morum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that the biggest challenge is getting it to the right people. I've done a lot of jobs talking at, you know, at big conventions to MSBA, to our, you know, our school board association. And I ask all of you and the people that are behind me as well in the audience, share. share the good work that we're doing. You know, Jenny and I are just one and two, and Akethia make three. But as we do, as we think about it, as this ripple, as you're all sitting here at the table, go back to your school board, go back to an administrator that you know, go back to a school counselor, someone that knows, because we all know these kids, right? We all know these kids in our area that we live, and encourage them to check in out. Call us, email us. I will answer the phone any time of day.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that if this program had existed at the time we were growing up, Representative Litzlegard and I might not even be sitting in this chair. So look forward to supporting this bill today.
Thank you. Lead McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Litzlegard, would you consider an oral amendment on 1.11 and add District 879?
Representative Litzlegard.
My city, of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll pass at this moment, and we'll set up another subcommittee to discuss that further.
Lee McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great bill, supported 100%. I should have put my name on it, but got the stamp of approval.
All right. Any closing remarks, Representative Litzlegard?
No, just thank you, Madam Chair. No, I think that the testifiers and the last testifier said it all, and I couldn't say anything better than that. So appreciate your support.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll renew the motion that.
Real people get real results.
What's the House File? House File 1996 be laid over.
Thank you.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Just kidding, nobody say aye. Okay, final bill for today is House File 10 from Representative Litzlegard. I move that House File 10 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. We do have an author's amendment, coded A23-0067. I move adoption of the A23 amendment. Members, you will see that there is a comparison document provided by the reviser in your folders. Any comments, Rep. Litzlegard, on the amendment?
Nope, it just gets the bill in the shape that I would like it as I present.
Wonderful. All those in favor of adopting the A23, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Would you like to go ahead and explain your bill, Representative Litzlegard?
I sure would. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. I am proud to once again carry House File 10, a bill to enhance public safety and create safer work conditions at Minnesota's oil refineries. You've heard me present this bill before, but in 2023, this will be the year that it passes. Madam Chair, I'm pleased to be joined today by my brothers and sisters from the skilled trades who are behind me today. Many of them work in these refineries, and they have seen firsthand the need of this bill. As a former labor, Local 1097, and a former steel worker, Local 4108, I know the importance of worksite safety and the value of skilled professionals who take safety seriously. To the men and women behind me, I say thank you. It is your skills and effort that has built and maintains this great nation. And I'm glad to be here for you today, as you are there for us. Now, is it Mr. Chair? No, I'm switching. Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, the heart of this bill.
Earlier announcement, where we're going to be doing a lot of this.
Okay.
Different people had different bills up elsewhere, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The heart of this bill hasn't changed since it was first introduced 2 years ago. You know, it raises the training and safety standards of those who work for contractors at the state's two oil refineries by requiring that a percentage of all contractor employees be graduates or apprentices in a registered apprenticeship program. As we know, registered apprenticeship programs are the gold standard in the workforce development. You know, many of my colleagues have toured these training centers. You just witnessed the bill prior to this, the commitment that these trade unions put forth. I'm a former steel worker that was an apprentice. an apprentice, and I had to get checked off. I had to meet certain criteria. This bill isn't about union versus non-union. It is about individuals having the proper training to do the proper job. Your skills need to match the task at hand. That is what this is. There are people both directly and indirectly that can be affected by a poor choice, lack of knowledge. They can have lasting, devastating effects. And that is what this bill is today. We have tried. We passed it out of the House in a bipartisan way, but it got stopped. We are here today, and I can honestly say that I'm proud that the trades leadership has worked with their members, and they all worked with the refinery. This is a better bill because of the company and the union working together. They may not agree 110%, but this bill is a better bill because people came together. So I have testifiers here today, Mr. Chair, if you listen, and he'll walk through the bill, and we'll be able to answer any questions you may have regarding this.
And I have a list in front of me of testifiers. First one is former Representative Chris DeLaForest. Welcome to the committee, classmate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, members of the committee. It's good to see you. Christopher DeLaForest, for the record, I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council, which represents over approximately 80,000 unionized construction trades professionals across the state of Minnesota. And my role today here, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to walk through the A23 amendment, which of course is the DE amendment and now comprises the bill. We'd be happy to do that. I would say at the outset, as Representative Liz Lagarde had noted, there's been a lot of discussions. And so I think what you're going to see here in this A23 amendment, a little bit of housekeeping, some substantive changes that represent consensus, and a couple of substantive changes where we're not quite there yet. Peace in the valley, no, but maybe peace in the gully. We're still talking to each other, and we'll continue to do so. So, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, 1.22 is the first substantive change, and you'll see throughout the A23 amendment where effective dates have been changed. That is an item of consensus. We think it makes sense, all the parties do, to have a longer implementation date here for a number of reasons I can go into during committee discussion if it's the committee's desire. Turning to page 2.1, you see a number of definitions that work through here. In particular, I would draw the committee's attention. Beginning on 2.22, you see subpart 3, and then on 2.25, subpart 4. That's an expansion of how we define safe and skilled. It is an item of consensus that attempts to draw a broader labor pool. Continuing on to page 3 with definitions, you will see on 3.6 and then on 3.19, that is a safe harbor for original equipment manufacturers. It's fairly standard, found in other statutes that have safe and skilled requirements, as well as some site-specific agreements between the trades and refiners and other management. Next, Mr. Chairman, 3.24 through 3.26, you have two substantive changes, as I alluded to just a moment ago. Effective dates are changed, but also importantly, you see really what comprises the heart of the bill here, and that is the safe and skilled requirement, which is phased in 30%, then 45%, and then 60%. Those who have been with this bill in prior sessions will note that this is a significant reduction and is nonetheless an item of consensus here that the trades do support. The next substantive change, Mr. Chairman, is found beginning on 3.27, but specifically on 3.30. It is what we call a right of first refusal. That is, if the call goes out for a contractor to provide the safe and skilled workforce and that workforce is not provided within 48 hours, weekends, holidays exempted, then the owner-operator is exempt from the requirements of the statute. Next, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is 4.4, what we call an emergency exception. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. If, God forbid, there's an oil leak, there's a fire, Most people will not be concerned about the requirements of this or many other statutes, I'm sure. The next change begins on 4.10. This is sort of a hybrid in concept. It's an item of consensus, but we are still talking about the specific language here. But the main idea here with this is to provide a safe harbor, if you will, or a choice. And that is that the refiners and the contractors, they can reach an agreement via a project, a voluntary project labor agreement or a site-specific agreement, which would relieve them of the requirements of the statute. So it's an either or, if you will. There's been a lot of discussions amongst us about that. And again, I think all the parties recognize that in concept, this is desirable to have this voluntary safe harbor if desired, if an agreement can be reached, and therefore get outside of the requirements of the statute itself. Mr. Chairman, you have subdivision 3 penalties. That is under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So those who want to learn more can come Thursday at 8:30 a.m. I'm happy to talk about it if you wish, but I know that's a judiciary item. And finally, Mr. Chairman, 5.5, that is a grandfather clause. So if there are existing contracts that are in effect at the time this statute takes effect, there would be they would be grandfathered and wouldn't be subject to the disruption that may occur because of the requirements of the statute. Mr. Chairman, that's my presentation of the A23 amendment. I don't know if you want to take questions or move to testifiers, but I'm here.
Mr. De La Forest, we'll go to finish the testifiers, and then we'll go back to questions. And if you want to hang close, if you want to pull the chair over there and sit next to. And the next person I have on my list is Kate Peruchek. I'm sorry. Kate. Starting with Ben. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Peruchek, and I am Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am pleased to speak in support of House File 10 as amended. The requirements in this bill for a skilled and trained contractor workforce in the construction and maintenance of petroleum refineries will ensure workers have the skills and training needed to perform the work safely. There are more than 11,000 registered apprentices actively training in various occupations today in Minnesota. Around 90% are in the construction industry. Registered apprenticeship is a time-tested, employment-based training model that combines structured on-the-job learning with required related technical instruction. To be registered with the department, programs must deliver experienced journey worker supervision to guide and oversee apprentice work, a minimum number of hours of related technical instruction per year, and a minimum number of hours of safety instruction during the apprenticeship term. These requirements ensure high-quality training and effective knowledge transfer with an emphasis on safety as one of its core components. Well-trained workers improve workplace safety. That is good for workers, good for employers, and good for Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to my former colleague, Ms. Peruchek. Could you lay out for us what is the process for a registered apprenticeship program to become registered?
Representative Schultz, we want to get through the testifiers, and then we're going to go. She'll be sticking around so she can answer that. So can you answer that quickly?
Sure. Happy to, Mr. Chair. So an employer or a joint employer and union program can come to the department. They have to meet various standards of apprenticeship. So as I mentioned, has to be at least 144 hours of related technical instruction a year, at least 2,000 hours of on-the-job learning, and 50 hours of safety instruction. It also has to be within an apprenticeable occupation, which are determined by the U.S. Department of Labor. We follow federal law as well as our own requirements in Chapter 178.
Mr. Chair, I just have one very brief follow-up.
Quickly.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone who's allowed to veto that, or is it you meet the check marks and you're good?
Ms. Peruchek.
Mr. Chair, the commissioner evaluates the programs to ensure that they meet the requirements in federal and state law.
With that, the next person I have on my list is Ben Wiedemann. And if we to keep things moving, the next person I have is Ryan Bierman. So if you can get ready, and if you can kind of limit it to around two minutes, that'd be great so we can get to questions. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and committee members, for your time. My name is Ben Wiedemann. I've been a laborer for 19 years, and for a decade, I was a health, safety, environmental manager for a large contractor that specializes in maintenance and construction work throughout inside refineries, power plants, and chemical plants throughout the United States. I have experience in each of these high-hazard facilities throughout the country, but my work has been mainly focused in one of the oil refineries right here in Minnesota. I took great pride in developing and reviewing safety policies, procedures, writing job hazard analysis, job audits, incident investigations, and developing corrective actions, as well as working with Minnesota OSHA. My highest priority was to make sure that everyone went home the same way that they came to work each day. Oil refineries are a high hazard work environment. Some of the hazardous work scopes include using respirators, including supplied air respirators to perform their work because of chemical and respiratory issues or hazards, building complex scaffolds, working in excavations or trenches, working in confined spaces, or making lifts with cranes. Then add in that these employees work around running refinery equipment. Mistakes or failures have consequences in these types of facilities. Refineries are not normal construction sites. It's potentially dangerous for individual workers, co-workers, the surrounding community, and the environment. Why is it more dangerous? Let's say a scaffold is poorly constructed or used improperly. Failure could not only result in loss of life, but could damage key refinery components, which could cause environmental and community impacts. Another example, imagine a crane lift that could be lifting thousands or even hundreds of thousands of pounds. Failing, the result could be catastrophic, and these are only two examples. That is why refineries need a well-trained workforce. In my career, it was easy to spot the difference between workers that are trained in registered apprenticeship programs and those who are not. They understand their specific job duties, no one to ask questions, and they contribute to a safe and productive culture of quality work every day. I believe it's good business and cheap insurance to have a high level of training for workers in these high-hazard work environments. Passing the Refinery Safety Act protects workers, the environment, and the community. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Again, next, Ryan Bierman. And after that, I got a Lucas Franco. If you want to be ready. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Ryan Bierman. Good afternoon, Chair and committee. My name is Ryan Bierman. I've worked at St. Paul Park Refinery just shy of 22 years as a vacancy relief operator in the crude area. I'm also chief union steward. I love my job. Myself and many of my coworkers are worried about the decline of the safety and training standards for contractors at the facility. I'm here today to talk to you about some of the troubling issues that I've witnessed with contractors and advocate for improved safety and training standards. The bill before you today will make sure that the refineries like St. Paul Park are safer places to work for employees and the people who live or go to school nearby. Let me be clear, a refinery can be a very dangerous place to work. A mistake can have catastrophic consequences. Using the wrong equipment to clean a tank, failure to use the proper PPE, incorrectly handling chemicals such as hydrofluoric acid are mistakes that not only can put the refinery workers at risk, can also put and expose the neighboring communities to a disaster. I've seen firsthand what happens when highly trained contractors are replaced with contractors who do not train their employees to apprenticeship programs standards. That is a risk that does not need to exist. I have also seen on-trade subcontractors that don't know how to use Minnesota fire hydrants, critical infrastructure for the safety of the plant, surrounding communities. I've seen entree and subcontractors use life-critical safety equipment, such as SCBA or self-contained breathing apparatuses, incorrectly. Puts myself, firefighters, my coworkers, and the community at risk. In conclusion, these guys don't know what they don't know. And that's a dangerous thing in a place like the St. Paul Park Refinery. With apprenticeship level training, these folks will be able to read a situation and be trained to ask the right questions.
If you want to wrap up.
Yep.
Thank you, sir. Lucas Franco. And the next person I have is John Bosch. Again, if you keep it to about 2 minutes.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Lucas Franco. I am the co-author of a report for Local Jobs North on safety conditions at a Minnesota refinery. Along with my co-author, I spent months in 2021 analyzing public documents and interviewing workers in an effort to better understand conditions at the facility. What we uncovered was disturbing and demonstrates the need for rigorous training standards at Minnesota refineries. Worker after worker shared stories of potential safety, health, and environmental hazards, from improper installation of fire safety controls to obviously botched cleanup operations. Workers told us that the refinery under study had been troubled for years. They were concerned that actions taken by the new owner made the facility more dangerous. These actions include elimination of safety tech and firefighter positions, removal of skilled local trades workforce, and at the time, locking out operations workforce. Workers reported numerous cases of avoidable safety lapses that were clearly the result of poor management or use of poorly trained workforce or both. Their eyewitness reports indicate that facility owners had brought in non-local workers who clearly lacked a basic knowledge of their jobs, refinery hazards, and or safety procedures. As shocking as the accounts were in this report, we're concerned that they're really only just the tip of the iceberg. In a refinery, seemingly minor mistakes can have serious consequences for workers and for surrounding communities. These risks can include worker or public exposure to hydrogen fluoride or HF. An EPA analysis found that a crack in an HF tank at the St. Paul Park facility could unleash a toxic plume that could travel up to 19 miles, potentially endangering as many as 1.7 million Minnesotans. The best thing policymakers can do to protect refinery workers and neighboring communities is to require rigorous training standards for the contracted workforce. HF10 sets a critical training threshold for work in a refinery. I encourage you to heed our findings about disturbing safety lapses at this Minnesota refinery. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. John Bosch, the next person I have is Jake Rindt. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm with Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 10 today. ABC is opposed to House File 10, which would mandate registered apprenticeship programs on private construction, something never before done in Minnesota. We have several members who help maintain and repair and build Minnesota's refineries, and there seems to be a misconception that the absence of a registered apprenticeship program has a negative impact on a contractor's ability to perform work safely. This couldn't be further from the truth. ABC's members have partnerships with MinOSHA, industry-leading safety programs, and customized in-house safety programs, craft training, and more, even though they are not registered with the state. They take pride in their work, and even more so, their safety record for each and every employee. Merit shop contractors may choose not to participate in a registered apprenticeship program for a variety of reasons. For example, merit shops often choose to provide in-house training due to the specialized nature of their trades and their market. The breadth of requirements in registered apprenticeship programs are not necessarily tailored to these specific crafts. ABC members also employ multi-skilled craft professionals who are capable of performing different types of work rather than limiting themselves to one trade. Current DLI requirements, however, limit these professionals to a particular skilled trade for the purpose of a registered apprenticeship program, making it difficult to accommodate these multi-skilled craft professionals. For example, it's not uncommon for our members' carpenters to help with concrete pours or tie rebar. This sort of efficiency may make someone comfortable, but it's what makes our members so successful. It's been said that anyone can start a registered apprenticeship program, and in theory, this is true. However, in practice, merit shop contractors have seen pushback from the building trades unions when they've attempted to start a new registered apprenticeship program that competes with a union program. For example, ABC experienced intense opposition when first pursuing our registered apprenticeship program in the early 2000s. Anyone can submit comments on these proposals, and the building trades unions submitted comments to the Department of Labor to pressure them to not approve our program. While ABC's program was ultimately approved, it was extremely disheartening that such efforts were taken to prevent the approval of a merit shop program solely for the reason that some folks are uncomfortable with fair and open competition. We agree with Representative Lizegard that this shouldn't be about union versus non-union, and if this requirement does move forward, we sincerely hope that we don't see additional efforts on behalf of this bill's advocates to oppose merit shop apprenticeship programs. While we are strongly opposed to the concept of mandating one-size-fits-all registered apprenticeship programs on private businesses, ABC members are resilient, and we will adapt to this mandate if forced to. Our merit shop contractors and their multi-skilled craft professionals will remain competitive and will continue to gain market share in Minnesota's construction industry, just as they have been doing for years. In closing, I strongly encourage the committee to vote no on House File 10 and to allow our members to continue to utilize the training programs that work best for their business and multi-craft professionals. Thank you again.
And next person up is Jake Wren. Thank you for your testimony. And after that, I have Lynn Granger. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jake Rent. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Flint Hills Resources. Flint Hills is a leading refining company with operations primarily in the Midwest and Texas. We own and operate the Pine Bend Refinery in Rosemont, Minnesota, which is responsible for producing the vast majority of Minnesota's transportation fuels and a significant portion of the fuels the surrounding states depend on as well. We are one of only two businesses in Minnesota that would be subject to this legislation. I believe we would also be the largest refinery in the handful of states around the country that have this legislation. We hire hundreds, sometimes thousands of highly skilled contractors to support our operations. Our maintenance events can exceed more than 3,000 contractors every day. We've had years where we've averaged more than 1,000 contractors on site every day, which, for perspective, is more than the total number of people who worked at U.S. Bank Stadium during peak construction. We're a busy place. Given the scope and complexity of our contractor workforce on which we rely, this legislation is hugely consequential to our operations. The vast majority of our contractors we hire come from the Minnesota building trades. We have long worked collaboratively with the leadership of the trades to promote the trades and to deepen the pool of skilled labor available in Minnesota to help support our operations. It's a partnership we value very much. We also work collaboratively with the Minnesota trades on workplace safety, which of course is our top priority. Today, Pine Bend is known for being among the safest industrial sites in Minnesota. We're very proud of that, and that would not be possible without the participation, cooperation, and partnership of the Minnesota building trades. It's important to emphasize we share the same goal as the authors and supporters of this legislation. We all want a safe, well-trained, well-qualified contractor workforce. I particularly want to thank Representative Lizegard and labor leaders for their willingness to listen to our concerns and consider changes, including some they've already adopted. So we very much appreciate that. We are still struggling a bit to understand the reason for the bill. Again, since we've had no complaints specific to our operation, that would merit, in our view, a change in state law. We have no awareness of any data that would support a change in state law as it pertains to our facility, or that these types of apprentice training programs for refineries make a difference with respect to safety. That said, again, we really appreciate working with the author and supporters of this legislation to try to improve the bill. I will note, however, that all experience and training are not the same. There is a difference between those that have apprentice-level training and those that have refining experience. Those are very, very different things. We have significant training requirements at our facility that go well beyond apprentice-level programs. These requirements...
You gotta wrap,
Yes. Thank you. Appreciate that. We also, for clarity, though, we do often expel contractors from our facility who do not meet our specific safety standards. So it's really important to us that this legislation not supersede or otherwise interfere with our site agreements that lay out these very specific safety requirements that have helped make our facility among the safest in the country. Lastly, we do have some contractors that are not technically in a training program that would qualify them to work at our facility should this legislation become law. Our hope is an exception be granted for those individuals who have experience working in our facility, have worked there very safely for years, that they be given the time and the opportunity to earn the training that this legislation requires so they can continue working in our facility. So again, nothing more important for us than safety. We appreciate the author's attention to this issue, labor leaders' ongoing willingness to work with us to make sure we're as safe as we possibly can be, and we look forward to keeping those conversations going.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Lynn Granger, and then the last person I have on my list is Mitch Horn. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed. And again, if you can keep it to 2 minutes, close as you can. Thank you.
Will do my best. Good afternoon. My name is Lynn Granger. I am the American Petroleum Institute's Midwest Region Director. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to share our concerns with House File 10 today. For the committee's awareness, House File 10 is nearly identical to proposals being pursued in nearby states, none of which have been adopted. However, like House File 10, each is a labor mandate posing as a worker safety bill. As currently drafted, House File 10 would impose workforce quotas on the state's two refineries, eventually require a percentage of contractors to be from certain certified apprenticeship programs, many of which are union-led, and force onerous compliance reporting and related penalties up to $10,000 a shift on these refiners. I'll briefly address several concerns we have with House File 10, which are related to safety, worker availability, costs, and timing. The safety and well-being of our members, employees, and contractors working in the downstream portion of the industry, as well as those living in nearby communities, is of utmost importance. This commitment is demonstrated by our refining sector's safety performance record that rivals the entirety of the U.S. manufacturing sector. Given these statistics across industries, it brings into question why the in-state refineries were targeted with this legislation. Additionally, House File 10 proponents have offered no data to support any safety issues at Minnesota refineries. To accomplish this consistent safety performance, companies must have the ability to select the right contractors to do work in their facilities. This is done by selecting the safest and most experienced contractors, whether they be union or non-union. Regarding workforce, we're concerned that this mandate or eligibility requirement could affect the availability of workers needed to perform highly skilled tasks. Limiting the contractor pool may very well result in less qualified contractors working in refineries or a delay to regularly scheduled maintenance. This is particularly true when the refineries are performing large-scale maintenance on the process units. These are referred to as turnarounds and often involve 1,000 contractors or more each day for several months. It is also important to note that apprenticeship-level training does not require industry-specific training. An electrical apprentice may have the skills and training to wire a house, but the skills and training needed to work in a large industrial setting, such as a refinery, are very different and more complex.
Time to a conclusion.
Refineries require flexibility to hire the safest and most experienced contractors for the highly specialized work within the refinery gate. Potential contractors are selected after a rigorous selection process that reviews their safety performance, management systems, and safety training programs. Again, API views union and non-union employees and contractors as vital to the industry. Of critical importance is the ability to utilize highly skilled and safe workers. However, House File 10 is not about safety. Rather, the proposal is the government inserting itself into the hiring practices of the private sector, creating an uneven playing field. House File 10 could also jeopardize worker and community safety, challenge the economic viability of Minnesotans' refiners, lead to immediate job losses and increased costs. As such, we respectfully encourage you to oppose this legislation. Thank you so much.
Mitch Horn, thank you for your testimony. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Horn. I am site manager for Turner Industries at Marathon St. Paul Park Refinery, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today regarding House File 10. First, I'll give you a brief overview of Turner Industries. We are an industrial contractor that's been in business for over 60 years. We offer 58 different services to industrial sites all over the nation, just like the two here in Minnesota. We work both non-union and union within these sites and believe that flexibility is paramount for an owner's ability to manage their unique site requirements in the safest way possible. As a contractor that operates inside these high-hazard facilities, the safety of our people and community stands above all else. We were extremely fortunate as a company to finish 2022 with an OSHA recordable rate of 0.20, well below the industry average, and operated in 404 sites OSHA recordable free. This is achievable in every single one of these sites. My goal here today is to shed some light to the impact this could have on the team I represent, and more importantly, the guys and gals I call family. In my understanding of this third engrossment, it could directly impact all 45 of our current employees and their families, most notably the 25 that are from the metro area with 133 years of cumulative experience within St. Paul Park Refinery, and the 13 that have relocated themselves, families, and are now committed to this same community. With us today are two of these individuals, Mike Tooman and Jim Kramer. Both are born and raised right down the street in Cottage Grove and are now raising their families in the same community. They each possess over a decade of experience within St. Paul Park Refinery, and their knowledge and experience is instrumental not only to Turner's safety and success, but the refinery and the community alike. Like all our employees, this is their home away from home. This industry can be very demanding, and often you spend more time with your work family than you do your own family. This bill, as currently drafted, threatens all of our team with only a handful of options or possible outcomes. One, this could certainly displace them of their work family and significantly impact their livelihood. Two, it could negatively impact their current career trajectory or inherently place a lower ceiling on that trajectory. And three, there are hundreds of sites outside of Minnesota that could potentially offer individuals opportunities and immediate positive trajectory, which leads to some very difficult conversations at home.
If you want to come to a conclusion.
Yes, sir. And following the progression of this bill, and as you've heard from other individuals that have testified today, I mean, it appears all parties have been actively engaged in conversation and continue to attempt to find common ground. With a vote in opposition today, I hope it will give all parties the proper amount of time to sufficiently assess every possible impact and outcome and truly come together in a manner that ensures it does not negatively impact the individuals involved, including the team I represent, the community, or the owner's ability to properly manage operations of these high-hazard facilities. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Discussion to the bill. I've got Representative Schultz on the Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I realize we only have a few moments left.
We're going to go a little bit long, but...
Okay, so our plan is to extend our discussion here. Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill's author, I do appreciate the fact that you've been willing to see this through this legislative session, work with all the stakeholders involved, and hear the concerns, because what we just heard is concerning for me, and I know it would be for you as someone who lost their job as a part of a closing of a facility, an industrial facility, high hazard, one could say, in some regards. So I know that you have great care for the workers, just like I do. You know, I think it might have been one of the only members you may have yourself walked the picket line at Marathon last year. And so what to the author, like, what are you, you know, as we look at this, this legislation appears that if you are a non-union employee, like, what is your path forward here to keep your job at the facility if you are a non-union employee?
Representative Lislegar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Schultz. To me, it's really simple. This whole bill is about safety and having the proper training. And so if I worked for a non-union company, I would be encouraging them, or I would be leading the way for that a non-union company to come up with a certified apprenticeship program where me and my family, working family, would have the ability to stay there. To sit back in this situation and not address the concerns that the gentleman that came up here and testified as a employee, direct employee, and him watching contractors come into the facility that aren't properly trained doing very dangerous tasks. So for me, if I was one of them employees, I would be pushing the non-union company to create what we're asking for, a certified apprenticeship program to make sure that individuals have the proper training to do the proper job the proper way. That simple.
Representative Schultz, one follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping that we would hear, and thank you, Representative Liz Lagarde. I was hoping that we would hear today a few more examples of how safety hasn't been the case for non-union contractors through the testimony that we heard. And so my concern is that, because for me, I think about the employees who have worked at this particular refinery, pick one of the two that we have here in Minnesota. They worked there for 5, 10, 20 years, and they might be the absolute best person because they know the area that they work. And one, now we would be shifting to someone else, fine. But number two, that person then isn't there for that, and they may be out of a job if they, in through their employer, don't have a registered apprenticeship program.
Representative Listener.
Well,
I don't know if there was a question here.
I don't hear a question, but I would just go back to, I'd organize. That's who I am. I'd organize, and I would be going out and finding out that proper apprenticeship program, whatever it is, to keep my family working. So, I mean, I don't know if your House Research has an opinion, but I can turn it over to
Representative. Representative Greenman, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate this. Thank you, Representative Lascard. Thank you for the folks who testified. I actually don't have a question because we've heard this bill a lot. And we've heard a lot from workers. And I will note for the record that the committee room is full of folks, workers, many of them from the plants were testifying. And so when I hear ABC and others sort of talk about safety and disregard those stories, disregard the workers who are coming and saying, what we need is to make sure that we have a skilled workforce. What we need is to not wait until something catastrophic or, you know, someone gets hurt. But in the issue of when we talk about refineries, we could be talking about not just worker injury, which is really important, but also injuries that could impact the entire communities. I think in this committee, we've talked a lot about worker safety. And a lot of times we come up as sort of, where are all of these catastrophic injuries? And I think that it is our job as policymakers not to wait. We should take action. And so I really appreciate this common sense bill. We hear a lot about apprenticeships. I think there's bipartisan support for pathways to apprenticeships. We just heard about that for apprenticeships. And now what we're saying is let's make sure that those that safety that we're investing in, that worker training that we're invested in, is actually in our statute. And the last thing I'll say is when we talk about unions, we're talking about workplace democracy. One of the ways that we know that workers keep themselves safe is by participating with management in unions to keep worker safety. Another way is by coming to us and saying we as policymakers should make take action to provide minimum safety standards. And that's what we're doing here. So I really just want to say I appreciate all of you coming and coming back year after year. And I hope that this is the year that we get it done. Thank you, Representative Listergaard, for all your work on this bill.
Representative Listergaard, and remember, Director.
Thank you, Mr.
Your
Chair.
Comments to the chair, yep. And questions through the chair.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really simple. You know, we work. This has been over 2 years, right? They could have came and presented that the non-union companies that they're referring to put together an apprenticeship program and checked all the boxes and made sure their workers were operating safely. I mean, it was just that simple. We wouldn't even be here. So our job at some point when people feel unsafe and there is an unwillingness to correct that action, that is when we have to step in. And that is exactly what we are doing here today, and that is exactly what is going to happen by the end of this session.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say welcome and thank you to all the workers in the room. I love it when this room is full of workers. I see a few of my favorite faces yet again in the audience. the workers that we're talking about in this bill are defined as skilled workers for a reason. They are the experts that go in and do those jobs every day, know the best way to do them, know the safety standards that it takes. And when the company doesn't listen to them, when they come with concerns, is why we end up with this bill. Representative Schultz, love serving on this committee with you. You were not the only member in the room who walked that picket line. I was there on the coldest night of the year at 2 a.m., brought them piping hot chili, and it was my honor to stay with them until the sun came up. Thank you to all the workers. Thank you for standing strong and saying we want to be safe ourselves, to have our families be safe, and have our communities be safe. Because if something happened at Marathon, there were two schools nearby that would have been affected by that, and it was built nearly in the middle of a neighborhood. So thank you, workers. This bill is simple. I look forward to yet another unanimous vote.
Representative Kozla. We have business to do here. Please keep the applause down. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Representative Lislegarde. This is a bill that I'm a really proud co-author on because it did happen in my community and impacted our entire area. And so asking where are these, catastrophes happening, we know them because we lived them. And, you know, one of the things that I just also want to say is that when we have rooms full overflowing, that we should stop and listen. And what I want to say to all of you coming here to Representative Lislegarde for carrying this bill is that I know you being in these spaces is for you, for our families, but as Representative Berg said, for our communities. I think that the number one job of a state representative is to take care of the health and safety of our people, and doing this with this bill will do that. And so with that, I would ask us to move to a roll call to take care of the health and safety of Minnesota.
Roll call's been asked for, so there'll be a roll call. See no further names on my list. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this quick because I know we're up against the clock in the other committee. Representative Lislegarde, is all about safety, and yet according to the API sheet on refineries, the refineries have one of the most safest working conditions of all manufacturing in the state of Minnesota. And I've been listening to this for 2 years as well. Matter of fact, I have two cousins that work at the refinery. He has told me that they have over 700 full-time employees every single day working on the safety, making sure it's safe. Now, nothing's perfect. Now, I think many people recognize that the apprentice shops have great programs for safety and education, but your particular bill will displace some folks that have had over 100 hours of experience working at the refineries and 30 years. Ms. Bursick, the Commissioner Vidali, said that in order to be certified as an apprentice shop, you have to have 140 hours of work. And then she said a couple other things. That is zero compared to the 30 years of, and 100 hours of experience that these refineries have. I haven't heard any evidence, substantial evidence, to completely overturn the apple cart that there is a huge safety issue. And one of your comments, you said, to the skilled workers, I say thank you. Certainly, to the skilled workers here, I say thank you. How about the skilled worker that works at these refineries, including my cousin, that have 30 years of experience and safety? You're just going to displace them? Because your bill, Representative Lislegarde, will do just that. So, and I had a question for you, Representative Lislegarde. If a contractor shop consists of workers with, say, over 100 years of cumulative experience working in refineries, 100 hours of cumulative experience working at the refineries. 100 years. 100 years. These glasses aren't very good, are they? 100 years of experience, we're not formally trained at a formally trained apprentice shop, but they have 100 years of experience.
Can you get to your questions?
Would this bill require the owner of the refinery to cut the contractors with the contract shop and replace the workers with the union workers? Because it does in the reading that I have read it.
Representative Lisa Clark. Well,
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, to your one comment, not all accidents get reported, and I'll just refer to the, you said API is the one who made that comment. You know, there's a lot of things that don't get reported to a higher level. And then to your, what was your second question? Oh, by the way, 100 years. Yeah, you said 100 hours, 100 years, potato. I would just say, you know what, if they had 100 years, they'd go through that apprenticeship program pretty fast, wouldn't they?
Representative McDonald, quickly, and then I got...
Okay, just to respond to that. Now, I've been in my profession for 35 years. I know it very well. To insinuate that because I didn't go to an apprentice shop because of your bill, that I wouldn't be good at what I did, that is ridiculous. So when you're saying that these refineries, these contractors that have 100 years of experience in safety and detail particularly regarding refineries, they aren't good unless they go to your apprentice shop that you're going to put in your bill, but they should be replaced with union workers, I think that is unfair to say that to those workers who have the experience and expertise in the industry. And then as far as the union shops, they're transient. They come and go. These workers are there permanently. And there you heard from the Turner, the representative, testifier. This is very important to them. It's their contract on the line. It's their life on the line. It's their families. But they will be out. Yes. Their experience will be out if your bill passes.
Mr. Chair, I'll just comment real quick, if I may.
That was Representative Listgard. I've got one more question, and then we're going to go to a vote. Otherwise, we're going to be out of time. So, Representative Myers, quick question.
Yep. Well, I just want to make a statement. You know, Chair, thank you. I've had a lot of conversations with stakeholders in this, and I appreciate Representative Listgard talking to people, continuing to talk to people, very specialized industry. And I hope as you continue to talk to people, and it's a little bit of what Lead McDonald says, is that we don't lose the workers that have the experience, the 10 or 15 or 20 years, because right now I think we all see that there's a lack of workers. So if we can, you know, continue to look at this and make sure that there's opportunities for those workers that probably provide the safest opportunities because they have that experience, I would just ask that you look at that. Thank you.
Representative Listgard.
Mr. Chair, I have one comment I have to say.
Quickly, Representative McDonald, we need to get to a vote.
I understand that. Representative Listgard, I've supported several of your bills in the past, one just right before this, and I enjoy our working relationship. I can disagree with you. That's fine. We're still going to be friends because that's what people do down here. You disagree, you agree, you still shake hands, and I find you to be a good man. But there's one thing that you did do today that I think I need to point out is you called out one of our staff and asked for his opinion on something. And I think as lawmakers, we don't want to be asking the staff what they opinion, although I think that they're very intelligent and sometimes their opinions are better than ours. I think as lawmakers, we got to be careful not to point out a staff member and ask their what their opinion is. Just proper protocol.
And he's better looking than anybody on the committee.
Amen.
Representative Listgard, 1 minute wrap up.
Well, thank you so much for the robust conversation. And to you, Representative McDonald, yes, you are a good man. And we agree to disagree at times. And this ain't my apprenticeship program. And there are all good workers, and it doesn't matter if they're union or non-union. But what the union, the trades do, is they assure whoever comes in there, there's a program put in place so people know that they're training and they're having the proper understanding of the task at hand. And there's documentation. Not just to hire somebody off the street to fill a spot where a contractor can get so much dollars per employee per hour. That's not what this is. Obviously, if it got to our level, there are serious concerns. Yeah. Else it would have never got to us. And they had 2 years to correct the problem. They didn't correct the problem. And by God, we are.
Thank you, Representative Listgard. With that, a roll call has been asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair.
And one second. Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 10, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Hendrickson.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Vice Chair Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Lead McDonald.
Nay.
McDonald, nay. Rep. Daniels, excused. Rep. Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Rep. Hill?
Hill, aye.
Rep Hill? Aye. Rep Hussein?
Aye.
Rep Hussein? Aye. Rep Jordan?
Aye.
Rep Jordan? Aye. Rep Kozlowski?
Aye.
Rep Kozlowski? Aye. Rep Mecklen?
No.
Rep Mecklen? No. Rep Myers?
Aye.
Rep Myers? Aye. Rep Schultz?
Aye.
Rep Schultz? Aye. Rep Wolgamont?
Wolgamont votes aye.
Rep Wolgamont? Aye. With that, the roll is closed.
With 10 ayes and 2 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to judiciary. And with that, members, no further business. We are adjourned.